That was the moment when I understood that the current understanding of MS is incomplete, and that who knew just how much recovery might be possible. Because up until then, I had learned to take each day simply as it unfolded, and I didn't know what any of it had meant. But when I rode my bike around the block, what I understood was, who knew what might be possible?
Hello, everyone. Welcome again to The Empowering Neurologist. I'm Dr. David Perlmutter. Today on the program, we're going to talk about multiple sclerosis. It's an autoimmune condition. We're seeing more and more of that condition in terms of its incidence, and noting that it is, like other autoimmune conditions in general, more common in women. Generally, when people get diagnosed with MS, there are a variety of drugs that are chosen to treat them to try to tamp down the immune system. But, you know, for many years, lifestyle factors have been recognized as playing an important role, primarily diet. You know, years ago, we used to do what was called the Swank diet. We're going to be talking about that today, but there's a better diet out there, and it's been developed by our guest today, Dr. Terry Walls. She's been on the program before. Dr. Walls is the author of a terrific book called The Walls Protocol. I'll read it to you: A Radical New Way to Treat All Chronic Autoimmune Conditions Using Paleo Principles. We'll discuss what Paleo Principles is all about. Let me tell you a little bit more about Dr. Terry Walls. She is professor at University of Iowa, where she conducts clinical trials testing the efficacy of diet lifestyle to treat multiple sclerosis, and certainly her protocols have been extended to other autoimmune conditions. We're going to jump right in and look at a very recent study that she just published, and I'm very much looking forward to reconnecting with Dr. Terry Walls. Well, hello, Dr. Walls. How are you doing?
Hi, David. So glad to see you.
I'm glad to see you too. We're going to talk about your new study, which compares a number of results that you evaluated based upon comparing your protocol versus the Swank diet, which is, you know, the only thing we had for so many years as mm-hmm. it related to an autoimmune condition, multiple sclerosis. But let's first take a step back a little bit, and let me ask you, why did you become interested in MS?
Well, I became interested when I was diagnosed in 2000.
There you go. And when you were diagnosed, you were offered up, I guess, the standard of treatment. How did that play out for you? And, you know, where I want to take it is how did we get to a place now where you're not just thinking about lifestyle issues, mm-hmm. but actually putting them to the test?
Yeah, you know, so I was diagnosed. I did some research, sought out one of the best MS centers in the country, which is the Cleveland Clinic, and saw their best person, took the newest drugs, and continued to decline. Now, at that time, I had trigeminal neuralgia. I had weakness in my left leg. 13 years earlier, I'd had an episode of dim vision in my left eye that they decided was probably optic neuritis. And at that time, you know, I was following the low-fat diet. You know, Swank diet was all that was out there. And so I was very carefully low-fat, and I was also a vegetarian. So it was probably more like the McDougall diet in many ways. Mm-hmm.
So in retrospect, you'd say that your diet would be, with what you know now, might have been sort of making the wrong choices, being vegetarian, risking being low in vitamin D, low in vitamin B12, and actually not leveraging the notion of how fats can reduce inflammation and balance immunity.
Well, you know, at the time, you know, I had really accepted the cholesterol hypothesis for heart disease, and, you know, Swank was all that we had. So I thought I was being as aggressive as I could be for managing my disease. It is, you know, it's interesting that in 2002, I clearly had lost a lot of ground. I couldn't run anymore. Walking was more difficult. Sitting up was more difficult. Fatigue was a bigger problem. And my physicians told me about the work of Lauren Cardain and suggested I look into adopting a paleo diet. And then that was a big decision, which I did do. So I slowly reintroduced meat. I gave up grain. I gave up dairy. Gave up legumes. So it was a very big change in my diet.
So what does that mean, a paleo diet? Why do they call it a paleo diet? And why might that be valuable for someone with an autoimmune condition?
Well, the theory, and Lauren Cardain was the fellow who advocated this. He said that the foods that were introduced when we became farmers were introducing new protein compounds that were unfamiliar to our species, and that they would have more lectins in them. And those are proteins with a sugar side chain. And depending on the individual, you may have an abnormal immune response to that. So he advocated for a lower lectin diet. He advocated for meat, vegetables, eggs. He suggested removing grains, legumes, and dairy. And so it took me several months to make that change. I did that. But unfortunately for me, I continued to decline.
And yet, you know, you did implement some pretty powerful lifestyle changes there and really trying to target your genome with different signaling. I mean, what you mentioned is that suddenly when we adopted agriculture, that was a huge shift for human physiology to try to, you know, to try to adjust to these lectins, these grains, these proteins to which, to any significant degree, our physiology had never really been exposed.
Correct. Now, you know, one of the things that I did do that was really very, very helpful, I'd been an athlete before becoming a physician. And once I was diagnosed with MS, I've sort of felt relieved to understand why my athletic performance had declined so much. But I knew I had to keep exercising as much as I could so I would stay as functional as I could for as long as possible. So I was committed, and I continued to do a workout every day, although it kept getting smaller and smaller and smaller, of course. And then it was impossible to jog, and that, of course, that happened very quickly. And walking was getting difficult very quickly. And I was sorting out, you know, should I put in a pool? And I was fussing over how expensive it was going to be. My mom sat me down very wisely, said, "Terry, for heaven's sakes, if this is what keeps you mobile, it's the best money you'll ever spend in your life. Put in the pool." You know, I did.
And any specific tricks on the temperature of that pool that you thought about?
I kept it cool. I kept it very cold. And so, you know, and I wouldn't heat the pool. So during the winter, it would get very cold. I was swimming in, you know, 72, then 68. It'd get as cold as 55 degrees. And so that is a cold swim.
Well, our friend Wim Hof would be very proud of hearing that. You know, it was many, many years ago, probably perhaps a century ago, when the diagnosis of MS would be made by putting people in the hot bath called the Uthof phenomenon, where their MS situation would deteriorate. So I think there's some wisdom there, though, from you, and that is that MS patients should be thinking about, you know, the possible issues related to getting too hot or overheated versus the benefits of cold. How bad did you get with your MS?
Bad, really bad. So we're going to take this on two realms. One is the fatigue and the motor function. Within 3 years, I am having difficulty walking. My physician suggests a tilt-recline wheelchair, which I adopt. And by 2007, I cannot sit up in a regular chair as I am now. I have a zero gravity chair, which I recline back with my knees higher than my nose. And I'm spending more time fully reclined or in bed. Another problem that I have is the trigeminal neuralgia, which is becoming more frequent, more severe, much more difficult to turn off.
Back then.
back then. So I was on gabapentin. First, I would take it just intermittently when these episodes would come on. Then I was placed on maintenance dose. Then I was on maximal dose. Then I was going to the pain clinic when these would turn on for injections. Then I was going to the pain clinic. Plus, I was taking Salumedrol. Then I was going to the pain clinic. Plus, I was now taking 5 days of Salumedrol to get it turned off.
So, a steroid.
Yeah. So in the summer of 07, you know, it's very clear to me that I'm headed towards becoming bedridden. I'm beginning to have brain fog. So I'm headed towards cognitive decline, possibly dementia. And that my trigeminal neuralgia is likely to turn permanently on and be unable to turn it off. And once it was turned on, David, I was, you know, a breeze in my face would trigger the pain, light would trigger the pain, sound would trigger the pain, talking would trigger the pain, swallowing would trigger the pain. So, you know, the pain would go on, would get turned on, I'd go to the pain clinic, I'd get my injections, get my Salumedrol. My kids would go stay with someone else, as would our dog. So things would be very quiet. I'd be in a dark room, drooling because I wasn't willing to swallow and I wasn't willing to talk. I was coming to terms with bedridden, demented. And my presumption would be, if my pain turned on where it was that permanently on, the agreement would be there would be no feeding tube.
That's quite a story. I mean, I've heard you lecture many times, and I've heard the part about the wheelchair and losing ambulation and the fatigue and the cognitive issues. But I think, you know, it's really helpful to describe this tic douloureux, the trigeminal neuralgia that you were experiencing, and how you know, many people suffer from that, and it can be devastating in terms of the pain, and sometimes it can't be remediated no matter what happens. But I think the point I'd like to make is that this can be seen in multiple sclerosis. So for people, mostly women, who are having that issue, it's worth a diagnostic of exploration that are there other issues that could have in the past been related, in your case, probably the optic neuritis, or what does the MRI of the brain look like? So that's actually very valuable. So here you are, can't do much. You're afraid to swallow because of your facial pain, keeping in out of the light, can't interact probably with people, can't walk, and things are looking pretty grim.
Things looking grim. You know, unfortunately, fifth day of Salumedrol, pain stopped, and so that's where I am in 2007. And of course, that looks like a very grim future, because what was clear, I'd been having those pains for 27 years, and for 27 years, they've been getting more frequent, more severe, and relentlessly more difficult to turn off. So, you know, I could unfortunately imagine that I would quite possibly find myself in a circumstance where the Salumedrol would not turn it off, and I'd be left with continuous, relentless electrical pain across my face.
And just for the viewer, Salumedrol is an injectable steroid, very powerful steroid, designed to turn down inflammation. And it sounds as if you did receive some benefit from it. Were these rhizotomies that you were getting, or what were the injections that you're talking about?
Well, those were injections on my scalp and along my C-spine of lidocaine and dacodron. And here, so I was getting multiple injections across my scalp and my neck that would turn the pain off for about 6 hours. Then they would come back, and I'm waiting for the effect of the Salumedrol. So I'd go in for injections every day. And, you know, eventually the Salumedrol would kick in, the pain would stop, I would not have to go back to the pain clinic. And then I would wait for when was it going to happen again next.
You know, it's one thing for a physician to have experiences with patients and write a book about it and help people, but, you know, this is first person. You know, you're ultimately dealing with MS patients, but look where you are right now in 2007, in terms of suffering from the very condition that you've made into your life work. So what happened then? When did things start to improve?
You know, so when I hit the wheelchair in 2003, that's when I said, you know, am I really doing everything that I can? So I went back to reading the basic science. And at that time, nobody was talking about mitochondria as being a player for MS. And my take in the literature was that I'd had a couple of relapses, but most of my course was this slow, relentless decline. So biologically, I thought I had much more in common with progressive MS. And so that was the literature that I was reading. And I was reading about neurodegeneration, which then got me into reading mitochondria. So my first aha was, okay, so what supplements could help the mitochondria work more effectively? So I'm adding those. What I can tell is that is slowing my decline. You know, it's sort of funny. I had taken this supplement cocktail for about 6 months, decided it hadn't done anything for me, so I stopped it and could not function at all. Then 3 days later, my wife Jackie brings it in and says, you know, honey, I think you ought to take all your supplements again. I took them and I could get up and go back to work. So I was very excited. A couple weeks later, I did the same experiment, stopped all my supplements, was completely exhausted, could not function, waited 3 days, resumed them, and could function. So my conclusion was the supplements were slowing my decline. They were doing more for me than my disease-modifying drugs at that time. And it got me much more excited about reading the basic science and experimenting on myself. In the summer of 07, I discovered, because I was on the Institutional Review Board, a study that used electrical stimulation of muscles in people with spinal cord injury. So I thought, well, that's pretty interesting, and convinced my physical therapist to give me a test session and to let me try that. The test session, by the way, was quite painful. But on the other hand, on the other side of it, I felt great, the best I'd felt in years. So I began adding E-Stim to my physical therapy and would gradually increase the dose of the E-Stim. And then about that same time, I discovered the Institute for Functional Medicine and took their course on neuroprotection. And as Kathleen Wilner, Lombard that I listened to. So I had a longer list of supplements and felt much more empowered that, yes, there are things I could be doing. So I added these supplements. And then a couple months later, I had another really big aha moment is, what if I redesign my paleo diet based on the nutrients that science said were really critical for my brain? So instead of being focused on what to avoid, I focused more on what I needed to be sure that I was eating. And yeah, that the first time that I started that was December 26th of 2007.
Day after Christmas.
The day after Christmas. You know, and I had been assigned to join the traumatic brain injury clinic. I wouldn't have any residents. I know my chief of staff had assigned me there basically to force me to face medical retirement because he knew it was a job. I probably no way I could do that physically. So in January, I go to this new clinic. The first couple of weeks, I just watch what's happening from my wheelchair. And then on the third week, it's time for me to get up and start, you know, interacting with patients. And seeing these vets. And at the end of that week, I realized, you know, that wasn't too bad. At the end of the next week, it's like, I can do this. And my energy is better. And, you know, my face hasn't bothered me at all. And 2 more months later, this is a sort of a stunning day. I had a letter to mail, and it was going to be down the hall about 200 yards. And I decided, you know, I wonder if I could walk there. So I had walking sticks in my office. I put the letter in my pocket, grabbed my walking sticks, and I walked down to mail that letter. And people were stopping me saying, oh my God, Dr. Walls, you're walking. What happened? Because it had been 4 years since people had seen me walk.
That's breathtaking. That's really breathtaking, because what we're hearing right now is the development of a story of somebody who didn't succumb to the status quo recommendations. You know, it's pretty much in mainstream neurology, you have MS. These are the handful of drugs that are currently being used. Hope for the best. And, you know, you out of necessity, you challenged that, you know, that whole paradigm, and you walked down the hall and mailed that letter. I mean, this is a screenplay for a movie, in my opinion. Love to see it. So you began to recognize that what you were doing was effective, with the premise that you were trying to enhance mitochondrial functionality, understanding then that the bioenergetics of brain cells seemed, and immune cells in the brain might be what you are targeting in terms of their regulation, that immune functionality and immune balance is an energy-dependent event throughout the body and certainly in the brain. So you adopt this diet, you're taking these supplements, maybe later on we could talk about what they may be, and with time things seem to get better for you.
You know, and about that time, my physical therapist is like, yep, you're definitely getting stronger. He has me starting to lift weights. Now, mind you, at first, these are really tiny weights, 1 pound little weights. But, you know, we advance my exercise routines. He's advancing the amount of E-stim that I'm taking. And that spring, I'm now walking around the block. I have it in my head that I'd like to try biking again. Because it's been 6 years since I've biked. It used to be a big part of our family life and my life. And that Mother's Day weekend, we have an emergency family meeting, and we decide that I can try biking. So my kids are going to jog along on either side. Jackie's coming up behind, and I push off, and I bike around the block.
Oh, my gosh.
So my kids are crying. Jackie's crying. I'm crying. And as I talk about it, you know, I cry again, because that was the moment when I understood that the current understanding of MS is incomplete, and that who knew just how much recovery might be possible. Because up until then, I had learned to take each day simply as it unfolded, and I didn't know what any of it had meant. But when I rode my bike around the block, what I understood was, who knew what might be possible?
I think the challenge, though, you just articulated, is that we're up against a dogma that is so entrenched and pervasive that what is purported to be the only approved treatment plan, taking a drug, is the only way to go. And you know, God bless Dr. Swank for trying something. I mean, I think you're going to tell us in a little while how that approach, a nutritional approach, how there were some upsides to Swank diet, no question. But that, you know, by and large, nutrition and an autoimmune condition, come on, we have drugs for that, especially these days, you know, with all the monoclonal antibodies that are advertised on television left, right, and center. You know, similar for me in neurodegenerative conditions like that are cognitive, Alzheimer's. We've seen the brilliant work of Dr. Dale Bredesen, the end of Alzheimer's. I mean, it's bold, but that is that's so iconoclastic, and that's a compliment. I mean, we were told that that's a one-way street, and perhaps there could be drugs that could slow the course, but the idea of reversing that decline and allowing people to regain cognitive function is still very much looked upon as being blasphemy, basically. And yet we see it happen. And here you are telling us in MS that you've had this nice blessed recovery.
Fortunately, the chair of medicine had watched me go from athletic to wheelchair to biking again. And he called me in, told me first to get a case report written up, which we did. Then he called me back and said, do a safety and feasibility study, test your protocol in others with progressive MS, see if they could do what you did, and what happens. So we did that. We published that. And then he was instrumental in helping us get some small pilot studies going, showing once again that, yes, people could implement this diet, this program, and that we could have remarkable improvements in quality of life, reduction in fatigue, and motor gains.
Well, those are big parameters. We're going to talk about them through the lens of the new study that you just completed. You were diagnosed with having chronic progressive MS, correct?
So originally it was relapsing remitting MS. But within 3 years, I converted to secondary progressive MS. And, you know, my neurologist, sat me down and said, okay, at this phase, the whole focus is to slow decline. So he recommended I take Novantrone and said there's a 2% risk of converting to leukemia each time you take the drug. And there's a significant risk to your heart each time you take the drug. But I was thrilled to take the drug because I already knew how disabled I was. And so, I took the drug, continued to decline. Then they said, look, this is not helping you, but we have this new drug, Tysabri. It's really quite miraculous. I'm sure that will help. So I did several cycles of Tysabri. That did not help. I continued, again, to relentlessly decline.
So we've got your work. You've been publishing these studies showing that a dietary intervention has a role to play, a very powerful role to play. Who knew? please.
Yeah.
So the new study, I'm going to just read the title that we'll be talking about. And we'll have to unpack this. Impact of the Swank and Walls Elimination Dietary Interventions on Fatigue and Quality of Life in Relapsing Remitting Multiple Sclerosis. So we've talked about the Swank diet, popularized in the late 1940s from University of Colorado or Oregon, I think Colorado. And Dr. Swank made some observations about MS being the differences in incidence in various areas. Was it Norway?
Yeah.
Of people that were living near the coast, ate a lot of fish versus those who were inland and eating a lot more of the foods that you ended up avoiding, grains, et cetera. And therefore implemented a study. I think the main thing that his study did was very reduced in saturated fat. I mean, I think that's a big take-home message. But you then used the standard Swank diet in a group of people, and another group of people put them on your protocol, which would be more along the lines of paleo, certainly nurturing the gut bacteria, which we should probably talk about if we have time today. But the protocol basically that you've refined, although I hate that word because it sounds like refined carbohydrate, that you've refined or you've tested on yourself and then obviously on so many other people over the years. And I'm not sure when this study was published. It says July 31st, 2021. So let's talk about this study. I think it involved 87 people, 12 and 24 weeks. And walk us through, first of all, the differences in the interventions.
So I want to step back just a little bit further. We had an observation period so that we could let everyone be compared to themselves as a control. And that we could document stability of the fatigue, of the quality of life, of walking, so that we'd have a comparison within and between the dietary programs. We also, and this was a big debate in our team, we improved the Swank diet. Swank, as he originally described the diet, focused entirely on saturated fat. He did not restrict sugars. He wasn't restricted refined grain. Vegetables were sort of a free food that you could take, although he did not have any prescription as to how many vegetables. So we changed that to have, we continued with the less than 15 grams of saturated fat, 4 servings of grain, preferably whole grain, and 4 servings of vegetables. On the wall side, we had 6 to 12 ounces of meat or fish, no grain, no legumes, no nightshades for the first 12 weeks, although we let people bring nightshades back after 12 weeks, and 6 to 9 servings of vegetables, according to gender and size. And the vegetables were divided between green leafy vegetables, sulfur-rich in the cabbage, onion, mushroom family vegetables, and in the deeply pigmented vegetables, things like carrots, beets, berries. We also encouraged organ meat, and we encouraged fermented foods, nutritional yeast, and just a little bit of seaweed. So the walls side had a much more clearly delineated dietary plan.
And then you apply various evaluations to these individuals at the outset, ultimately at several time points along the course. And we actually, from the study, we're going to look at some of these graphs. Let's take a look at that first graph if we can.
Sure. So, are we able to pull that up?
Yeah, our editing people right now are going to insert this. This is the FSS letter A in your study. So we're going to go back on. Okay, so we're looking at the first study, this FSS, which means what?
So that's fatigue severity scale score. And that was our primary outcome. It's a very short, very easy questionnaire, 9 questions, and it's used across many different disease states. You rate your agreement with how fatigue impacts various aspects of your life. And the score ranges from 7 total fatigue in every aspect of your life to 1, no fatigue in any aspect of your life.
So this is a subjective, patient-centered expression of basically how they're doing, with fatigue being really what we're really focused on. And it looks like, again, back to the graph, that in the Swank group, which is in the gray column, they actually seem to have they drop a little bit in their level of on the scale, versus a far more dramatic decline that we see at the 12-week versus the 24-week in your protocol.
Well, in the graph, you'll see there is a line that indicates clinical significance. So a change of 0.45 is clinically significant. So both Walls and Swank hit clinical significance. And we have to acknowledge that in terms of statistical difference between Walls and Swank for the fatigue severity scale, they were not different at either 12 or 24 weeks. So, but comparing them to the level of fatigue they had at run-in, when they first came in and they were eating their usual diet, there was a large reduction in fatigue experienced by both. And by the time you got to 24 weeks, Walls certainly had a greater fatigue reduction, but statistically not different between the two. So for our primary outcome, we didn't hit our goal, because we had predicted that the Walls would have a statistically and clinically greater fatigue reduction than Swank. From a public health standpoint, it's great to show that both Walls and Swank improved. Now, is part of the reason that we didn't see the difference that we improved the Swank diet? Well, maybe.
Yeah. So again, you, in a sense, you put the swank diet to the test too, and it looks as if there's efficacy.
Yes.
And as we'll see later on in the rest of the data, there are places though where you pull ahead of the pack. I mean,
absolutely.
Let's look at graph B, which is MFIS. Can we unpack that one a little bit?
Yeah. So that's the Modified Fatigue Impact Scale. That's a more sensitive examination of fatigue. It's a longer questionnaire, and there the clinical significant number is 4. And what you see there is that, again, both groups have clinically meaningful reduction in fatigue compared to the run-in period at both 12 and 24 weeks. However, the Walls group has clinically and statistically greater reductions in fatigue than Swank at both 12 and 24 weeks.
So then we're going to look at the mental quality of life. That's this now looking at this chart C. And one C is looking at this graph. This looks pretty dramatic in terms of what the Walls protocol is able to accomplish with these individuals.
So let me explain the quality of life measures. So this is based on the short form 36 quality of life measures. They've added some additional questions that are more MS specific, and have broken it down to physical health and mental health. Again, what you'll see is the Walls and the clinical significance difference is 5 points. And so within 12 weeks, there is a fairly robust, and you've got the graph in front of you there. I think it was 14 to 17 points at 12 weeks and at 24 weeks. So in the papers, we don't get to use the terms large clinical significance. That's always in the eye of the reader. So you can use that term, Dave, but I can say it all I want. So there is a robust difference from the run-in for the Walls group that is larger for the Walls group than for the Swank group. And that, again, that is statistically different and clinically very different. So there's a robust, again, it's a patient-reported outcome, but certainly very, very meaningful.
And then as we get to the next graph, D, this is the physical quality of life scale. And I want to point out that these are looked at 12 and 24. So this is really the change from the run-in. That's correct?
Okay. So,
go ahead.
Again, this is built on the short form 36 plus those additional questions that are MS-specific. It's a great way of looking at your ability to do the tasks of daily life. Again, 5 is the clinical significant difference. The Swank group does have changes that are just barely present at 12, more noticeable at 24. And again, if you look at the Walls group, again, it's 14 to 17 points at 12 and 24. In the paper, we don't get to call those large, but David, I'll let you make your judgments as to how significant
those changes are. Why do you think you're on the program today? I read the study multiple times, and I've been, you know, working with MS patients for more than 3.5 decades, and you know, I was around for the Walls for the Swank protocol. I was limiting total fat and saturated fat, so I'm a veteran of all this stuff. And when I see your diet that targets the microbiome, for example, and all, you know, and in our understanding of how that's immunoregulatory, it's thrilling. So let's get to the last graph, though, graph E, and this is GMWT, and I think this looks pretty intriguing
so,
as well.
So this is the 6-minute walk test, and this is a measure of endurance. Now, because this is a dietary study, we ask people to not add new exercise programs during the 9 months they were working with us, unless their medical team sent them to a physical therapist. And we put an actigraph on them. So we know, in fact, they did not add any new physical activity. So they followed that direction. So it's not surprising at 12 weeks, there was no change in endurance, because you wouldn't expect that. And neither Walls or Swank had any meaningful difference. And then at 24 weeks, which is really interesting, is the Walls group did walk farther, so we had greater endurance. It's clinically significant in terms of statistical difference. It's a p-value of 0.08, so not statistically significant, but clinically significant improvements in endurance because we improved people's diet. I think that's pretty cool.
More than that. So why? What's going on here? You know, we've had Dr. Gundry on the program talking about lectins and how pro-inflammatory they are, how disruptive they are for mucosal linings and barriers. We've had Dr. Fasano on talking about gluten and what that does in terms of zonulin and, again, barrier disruption. We certainly have talked about the microbiome for many years now and its role in immune regulation and inflammation. How do you encapsulate what's going on here with this diet and why it's seemingly so effective, not just for you, but for MS patients in general?
Well, because it is a system that lets us get to multiple biochemical pathways in the body. We're improving NF-kappa-B. We're improving intracellular antioxidant response element. Improving the myelin, we're improving cell membranes, we are feeding the microbiome. We also, as part of the protocol, corrected vitamin D deficiency when we found that. So if we're going to restore health, we're not going to ever be able to do that by a single molecular pathway. Programs that address multiple pathways through addressing dietary patterns, and ideally also including meditation, stress reduction, sleep, exercise, are going to be the ones that will be most effective. What I think that is so interesting is that even though all we did was focus on dietary pattern, we still improved endurance. Had I been able to do a multimodal program that included diet, stress reduction, attention to sleep, and exercise, the impact, of course, would have been far more magnified.
You know, and you could double-click on any of those things and describe biochemically why they are good choices, why exercise via stimulation of AMP kinase and its role in metabolism, upregulating BDNF production, so that's a trophic hormone that the neurons love. How this, the organ meat part of the story, for example, the vitamin B12 that might be available that through that meditation, reducing cortisol disruptive to the gut lining, threatening neurons specifically, high levels of cortisol. So it all comes together, and I'm thinking right now, and I would bet that many of our viewers are thinking back to the Dr. Bredesen most recent time on the program, where he basically said exactly the same thing. That
you
we aren't going to fix. Pardon me?
You want to do it all.
We live in a world of monotherapy and are seemingly convinced that there is a magic pill for our ills. And what you're describing is attacking this problem through, you know, multiple inroads, jumping on that carousel at multiple stops to realize an improvement, which is it the end all? Perhaps not. I mean, is there a place for medication? Perhaps so. But to do one to the exclusion of the other, I think, isn't fair, to doesn't serve patients well.
When I first started doing my research, that very first program, the reason I was able to get it through the IRB was that my chair of medicine had become the dean of the College of Medicine. And behind the scenes, he helped get that protocol approved. Because people said, if it worked, you wouldn't know the mechanisms. Fortunately, Paul Rothman said, but the first question is, will people do it and could it work? Then you could begin to do studies to look at the mechanisms. We have a study right now in newly diagnosed MS patients where we are back to my multimodal roots. diet, meditation, exercise, in a cohort of people, David, who said, newly diagnosed, I'm declining drugs, I'm going to do diet and lifestyle. We're following them along with another cohort of folks who are doing drugs, and most of them are also doing diet and lifestyle. And we're following their clinical course. And how many people have progression, have improvement, have relapses. We'll have our last person through that study in July of 2022. We'll be analyzing the data. And hopefully we can come back and talk with you when we get that paper published.
Well, we'll count on that. And let me just revisit something you just said about, you know, we live in a world where mechanisms kind of lead, where that's the horse before the cart, that we have to understand a mechanism whereby this drug targets a certain receptor and lowers blood pressure. And then we'll try it on animals, then we'll do a human trial because we know the mechanism, and lo and behold, then there'll be an approved treatment. But is it really always necessary to have the mechanism understood to lead the way in situations where there's no downside? I mean, you can understand risk-benefit ratio as it relates to a drug, but when you're talking about the things that you are doing, there is no downside. And if people are improving, then why is it so fundamental that we delineate every aspect of the mechanism?
You know,
some might say this is placebo effect. And I would say, okay, who cares? The patients are getting better. You can call it whatever you like.
When I first started doing my research and talking about my experience, many neurologists, certainly not people like you, condemned what I was doing, creating false hope, condemned my research. I was severely criticized nationally, somewhat criticized here at the university. But now that we've had more success with our studies, now slowly we are seeing more multimodal studies that are focused on creating health through diet, lifestyle, mechanisms. And I think the early work that we did and published was key to that success. The other thing that's been key is because my protocol has been so successful with helping people who have resources, who then have contacted the University of Iowa to say, we believe in what Walls is doing. We want to support her lab, and we're happy to write a check. So I've been able to do these remarkably innovative studies, not because of the NIH, but because of philanthropy from grateful patients.
Mm. That says it all, doesn't it? I mean, that is really, ultimately, that's what you aspire to. So I want to let our viewers know that your book is called The Walls Protocol, and it talks about what we've talked about today. And I have to say that it remains on the top of the list of Amazon books that are dedicated to neurological disease. And I'm so happy about that because your work is so good. And I'm just encouraging our viewers to read that book. And I'll make a promise to everybody that we'll have you back on the program with your next study and keep doing it as your studies come out.
Thank you. You know, we have another study that we will be launching probably in the next 2 or 3 months, comparing the modified paleo diet, a ketogenic diet, dietary guidelines. We'll follow people for 2 years, and we will have MRIs at the baseline at the end of the study, and we'll be getting neurofilaments along the way. So if you want to be aware of that study, you can look for that announcement at walls.uiowa.edu.
And through the magic of video, that is going to appear on the bottom of your screen as we speak. And having said that, you sent me a link to an interesting article about neurofilament several days ago. Tell us what that talked about and why that's going to be a really important tool.
So we've been searching for some time for blood biomarkers that we could use as a way of monitoring changes in the brain. The leading biomarker right now is this neurofilament light chain. That has been correlating very well with a number of enhancing lesions, the volume of enhancing lesions, and the rate of brain atrophy. This paper that I sent to you looked at a study that had been done in Germany comparing in 60 folks, 30 that followed the usual German diet, 30 that followed a calorie-restricted diet for a week, and then switched over to a Mediterranean diet, and pardon me, it was 20 in each group, and 20 that followed a ketogenic diet. And then they measured the neurofilament levels at baseline, 3 months, and at 6 months. What I found exciting was that the ketogenic diet group demonstrated favorable changes in the neurofilament levels at 6 months, so that we could begin to use a neurofilament marker as a measure of what kind of damage is occurring in the brain. Because if there's more damage, that neurofilament marker level goes up. If there's less damage, the neurofilament marker goes down. And what makes me excited is I have a freezer of specimens from my prior studies. So we've just submitted a grant proposal to investigate our freezer looking for neurofilament levels.
Hmm. Now, why the interest in ketogenic diet?
Well, the ketogenic diet, we have a long history or a longer history that's been very helpful in seizure disorders. That became quite popular in the 1960s. I believe Charlie was the little boy who had a seizure disorder and some neurodevelopmental issues, who remarkably improved on a ketogenic diet. And there's been a great deal of interest in ketogenic diets, in the seizure disorders, in cognitive decline, in some Alzheimer's studies. It's been a little more difficult for the mental health studies because of compliance. It's also being investigated for insulin resistance disorders. I have investigated it for MS. I've followed ketogenic diets for many years myself, although I'm doing more of an intermittent fasting program presently. There are a couple of studies using ketogenic diets for MS with favorable outcomes. And our grateful patient has had tremendous success with the ketogenic diet. And so I said, we would love to do a longer study of the ketogenic diet, dietary guidelines, and a modified paleo diet.
Hmm. Well, I think it speaks back to your original observation or conclusion that perhaps mitochondrial upregulation may be fundamental here in immune balance and in just brain energetics in general. That's the so-called bioenergetic theory of MS. And so I'll be interested to hear how that comes out. We've, as you mentioned, seen really nice work by Dr. Matthew Phillips in New Zealand in both Parkinson's and now a new paper in Alzheimer's. The use of this diet as it relates to type 2 diabetes. We had Dr. Sarah Hallberg on the program talking about, not just getting blood sugars down, but turning the diabetes off. I mean, what drugs do we have today that actually cure diabetes? You know, the sulfonylureas, metformin, et cetera, they get the blood sugar down, sure, but you're stuck on the drug. And, correct. You know, she's demonstrated how powerfully effective that can be. And, these metabolic issues certainly play into our immune dysfunction issues, autoimmune issues as well. So it might well be why another reason why we're certainly seeing a powerful uptick, a significant uptick in autoimmunity these days. You know, I think the decline in the dietary quality that we're seeing around the world, is probably front and center. Now see such dramatic changes in the microbiome, increase in inflammatory markers, higher uric acid, across the board. So I want to thank you, and a good standing invitation for the next study when it's completed. Be delighted to have you back. And again, for our viewers, the book is The Walls Protocol. We're going to put a link to this incredible study on the website. And Dr. Walls, thank you so much for your time.
Great. And I'll get you the links for our upcoming study.
That'd be great. Talk to you soon. Well, that really was a very, very interesting discussion of her latest research. Again, I'll read to you the title of the study, Impact of the Swank and Walls Elimination Dietary Interventions. We talked about both of those things today, on fatigue and quality of life in relapsing remitting multiple sclerosis. What a breath of fresh air to recognize that here is a protocol based upon lifestyle change that has such an effect on some of the big issues that relate to MS patients. Again, Dr. Terry Walls, we're very grateful that we've had her on the program. Always a terrific guest, great information. I'll be back soon. This is the Empowering Neurologist, and we'll see you.